Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Aloha Friday, May 10. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. Can a community organizer better organize this community?
Honolulu and vicinity can expect rain with scattered hair.
Corralling support for degraded coral.
Son, let me tell you about the new moon.
Plus, rezoning hazardous real estate in the backyard, a reality check of the numbers to fund homeless housing, and the worldview from the BBC.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We waited the additional week until the plan was ready, and yesterday got a look at what Honolulu's mayor proposes to do to home the houseless. The two-year pilot program is different from previous plans. It's concerned with just getting 100 of the city's chronic homeless into housing, and then using that as a portal to other services. The mayor also wants apartments sprinkled throughout the county to keep homeless folks in the neighborhoods they already inhabit. That means the number of single-room units will have to grow, and later, so will the money to make the program sustainable. Jun Yang is the mayor's director of housing, and he joins us this morning. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, good morning. I really do always appreciate to come to the conversation. Thank you.
And it's good to have one with you about this, because this is a long-time issue, and
yes,
it seems that there's been so much emphasis placed on it in the last year or so that something feels like it's moving forward. But there's the realities behind all of those good feelings. And with the pilot program, it seems as if we're doing something that perhaps we should have done a long time ago. Just get people into housing.
Yes, we've taken a few stabs at this. We've tried by first in Chinatown, the River Street Project. What we learned through each of these iterations is that we need to get the community's buy-in, number one. And number two, we learned through the Waikiki Pathways project that we were not able to get off the ground. We learned that we need to make sure that the operation funds are going to be there, the wraparound services are going to be a part of the project. So this time around, myself and the director of the Community Services Department, Pam Witte Oakland, we work closely to find a way to make sure that we get the wraparound services for our homeless, our chronic homeless. And this is our initial plan, a ramp-up plan to be able to work with up to 100 of our chronic homeless in our community.
You talk about getting community buy-in and some of the other plans that we saw that didn't go forward, downtown in Chinatown with the River Street Project and others that you've mentioned and we've watched, unfortunately, come through with great hopes only to be dashed, because the community didn't want people in their community to be, invisible. They wanted them to be more invisible than visible,
absolutely,
but they wanted to know that they were maybe going to be invisible someplace else, not there. So how do you combat NIMBYism? That's not going to go away.
Well, what we have to do as a city and as the homeless service provider community is to educate our community a little bit more. Go into the businesses, go into the neighborhood boards, go into the neighborhoods and talk about what homelessness looks like in each of our communities. What we know in Waianae, our Waianae community will take care of the Waianae community. They are a fantastic group of families out there. And when they have their homeless in the community, they will stand up and say, we will begin to work with our homeless here, and we will work to house them. They are fantastic on that.
So what about Chinatown and Waikiki?
Well, in Waikiki, it's been a big shift, and we've seen a huge positive shift in that in the beginning, the hotel industry, the neighborhoods didn't know what to do, and they were just asking, can you move our homeless off of the streets and to a place where we can't see them? But we've seen a shift where even the businesses, the hotels are saying, hey, if we can help be a part of the solution, we'll come to the table. We'll come with what we can. The neighborhood boards are saying, we have such a big issue here in Waikiki. We know that there are no shelters nearby. if we can help you find something, if we can work with you, we will. We want to be positive in the conversation and not say no, no, no.
So, John, what does that help look like when they say that they're ready to come to the table? What exactly have they told you that they're willing to do that they weren't willing to do a couple of years ago?
Well, to accept a development within Waikiki is a huge step forward in what we learned through the River Street Project, which would have been a good development. What we're seeing in Waikiki with the Pathways Project that didn't move forward was that the Waikiki Neighborhood Board, many in the community there, the businesses were all behind it, supportive of this project, saying, we have such an issue within our community in Waikiki, let's do it here. That's a huge shift from anything that we've had previous. So if we are able to do that, the Waikiki Business Improvement District has come with some pictures and some real estate sites and saying these could be possible sites to
so
do.
So they're coming offering particular
Absolutely.
Places where it might be okay
Absolutely.
Then to house homeless people within
so,
Waikiki.
So my job, together with the Department of Community Services, is to go into the community and to talk about what are the services that are going to be needed, what does it look like, because we're not asking a homeless person to just go into a unit and they're just going to be there by themselves.
No, the idea was to make that the portal to the services.
Absolutely.
But don't we know what those services are? Haven't we studied this over mm-hmm. one side and down the other so that we know pretty well what someone who is homeless, of the various varieties of homeless people, because a homeless person is not a homeless person is not a homeless person. Don't we know that already?
We do. What we are showing in this action plan is we want to actually just take the barriers away from the housing for a homeless person. Right now, the homeless service providers have told me plenty of times that if you provide the housing, then the treatment can come. The treatment right now becomes a part of that problem, becomes a little bit of a barrier. And so we want to take those barriers away, allow the person to come into a stable environment, and then work with the case managers at that point to provide all the services that they need. Now, of course, there is no mandatory program participation, but we see throughout the nation that those who actually do participate in or actually come into housing, the majority of them do participate, and over, I think it was 87%, actually stay within housing for the long term.
There is going to be a bit of a timing situation because a lot of this doesn't really kick in until close to the end of this year
yes.
and January next year, which has raised a couple of eyebrows because meanwhile we still have Bill 7 and people being pushed off the streets going and they're going to go where? What happens?
Well, Bill 7 is an ordinance that the city council has passed that the mayor is supportive of. What it is providing access to the sidewalks and public spaces. We know that there will be some impact, and what we're working with our service providers to make sure that they at this point they do have open beds within their shelters. We're asking our Department of Facilities Maintenance and Honolulu Police Department to work with our service providers, which they do at this point, to provide help cards to actually let them know and have caseworkers, outreach workers, to go out previous to any of these enforcements, to go out there and actually let them know that there are services provided.
But there's still a pretty rancorous situation happening, particularly with the Deoccupy Honolulu people and others. And we're going to have to let it go at that. Will you come back and we'll talk more?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much for being with us this morning. Jun Yang is 3 months into his job as executive director of the Mayor's Office of Housing. He worked as a community organizer for a California grassroots group on affordable housing and low-income development. In 2008, he moved to Honolulu to become the lead organizer for the Faith Action for Community Equity, otherwise known as FACE. The mayor's pilot plan to house the homeless is on our website. If you want to look at it, just go to hawaiipublicradio.org. We'll be right back.
This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, we take Sergeant Pepper with a grain of song, do the reality check numbers with Civil Beat, and see if we can prevent critters from doing a number on our coral.
Umurokai, Ulanai, Umau, Ukaholabe, Ohavaiti.
Today in the backyard, let's go back in time to Mo'olelo Kahiku, the days of ancient legend. 2,000 years ago, Hawaiians believed Lanai's lava glowed, and not just from Pele's fire. It said the ancient Hawaiians steered clear of Lanai because they thought the island was lit by the mana from evil spirits and demons, a dark, mysterious mana by day and eerily iridescent in the black of night. Not at all like the Lanai of today or even the island of small fishing villages from the 19th century kingdom. Around 1500 A.D., Lanai was finally made safe for the common people to inhabit. So, our backyard quiz question for you today. According to Hawaiian folklore, can you name who or what made that possible? We'll fire off the answer in the next half hour.
If your experience of the Beatles dates all the way back to their appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show back in the day, you don't need this explained to you. No other band has had the impact the Beatles had, and no band ever will. This is no 60s nostalgia. It's about a group of musicians who were incredibly prolific within a short period and created a body of work that covered an astonishing musical range. Along the way, these four guys stamped their personalities on our imaginations. We knew them. Not that easy, then, to recreate the magic, but Mark Lewis took up the challenge many years ago and made it his life. He's the founder of Rain, the Beatles tribute show that's coming to town, and he's with us this morning.
Hey, Chris, how you doing?
All right,
it's great,
Mark,
to be here.
Good to have you on the show. There's a really incredibly rich vein of material created by these guys in, what, 6 years?
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, when you consider the short span that they were together,
yeah,
and the body of work, and not just the body of work, but the quality,
yeah,
of the work and the range of the work, from the earliest Beatles songs like Love Me Do and Please Please Me,
yeah,
through Side 2 of Abbey Road, Sgt. Pepper. If I say to you, I Want to Hold Your Hand, Yesterday, Strawberry Fields, While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah.
There's such diversified songs and all done by the same group over a period of maybe 5-6 years. It's absolutely amazing.
And they're not just three-chord rock and roll songs, are they?
No, they're not just three-chord rock and roll songs. They're very intricate, and the more that we've played them, the more we realize and understand and respect what was involved in creating not just the music but the recordings themselves, which we consider it our goal to bring it to people in a live environment, which is what Rain is all about.
Well, once the Beatles got their chance and got recording contracts and became an established band, they brought an enormous level of skill that they'd acquired from before anybody even heard of them, correct?
That's correct. And I think that their age and their huge success and what I consider to be a very healthy competition between Lennon and McCartney, it was,
yeah,
sort of created this perfect storm for them to be writing all of this great music over such a short period of time.
Yeah.
They wanted to be on the record. They knew that the record was going to be heard by millions of people. And I think it just planted the seeds for them to just keep creating and creating. And the amazing thing is each album that they put out was different than the previous one and sort of set the standard for music in general and pop music, rock music,
yeah,
and what followed. And not just the music, but the look, the attitude, peace and love, psychedelia, as they,
yeah,
would say, All of it came down to what did the Beatles do? Now look what everybody else is doing too, you know?
Well, it was not the custom pre-Beatles for essentially teenage bands or bands making music for teenagers to come in and say, we want to write our own songs, do our own material, and even play our own instruments. That really wasn't done pre-Beatles, at least in American rock and roll.
That's very true. And not only did they write their own music, but they had several writers in the band.
Yeah.
They had Lennon, McCartney, and George Harrison,
and George,
who we know is a great writer in his own right. Writer in his own right, is that?
Yeah, to borrow a phrase from John Lennon, right? Well, you know, the early albums, you know, George was always chafing to get more than one song onto the album. He knew that was maybe, if he's lucky, he was going to get one or two songs. But there was a competition with George and the other two guys in terms of George coming up as a songwriter. He eventually became a great songwriter, didn't he?
Absolutely. And I kind of feel for him because he is a great songwriter, but he happened to be kind of sandwiched in between two of the best that ever lived.
Exactly.
It's kind of like, you know, what could you do? You know, it's like you got a guy like Paul McCartney on one side and John Lennon on the other side, you know?
Well, there was that inspiration that you and I had growing up of seeing these guys on the Ed Sullivan Show, not that much older than we were at the time, and yet, you know, knocking the world on its rear with what they did, holding the instruments in their hands, playing them, no canned backup, nothing of that stuff.
That's true. I feel very fortunate to have grown up in that era. I think the Beatles music and the Beatles themselves, they're the whole thing about the Beatles is going to live forever, and I kind of feel fortunate that I remember what it was like to go into a record store and buy a Beatles record and take the cellophane off the record and take out the album and not know what this album called Rubber Soul has on it, and putting it on and hearing those songs for the first time and realizing how different it was from the previous album.
I know. Rubber Soul on, everything was a complete surprise, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Then came Revolver, Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah.
Like I said, such great diversity and always great vocals, great words, great arrangements, great harmonies, great musicianship, great production. It was just a sort of just perfect combination of everything. A different look. They sounded different when they spoke. They wore their hair different.
Yeah.
They dressed different. And they could actually deliver the goods. That's the most important thing, because at the end of the day, you play their music and it lives or dies on the quality of what they created. And we all know where that that wound up.
If the music weren't brilliant and complex, you would have gotten bored with this stuff a long time ago, wouldn't you? I mean, you have the task of recreating a lot of very subtle touches that most people didn't even know about at the time. They just were part of the overall effect.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, it's kind of like we always look at the band and what we do, which is recreating the music of the Beatles live and their performance, as a work in progress.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess because of modern technology, we now have the ability to really dissect the Beatles' music. And after doing it for decades, we still hear, like you might hear a John Lennon rhythm guitar part that's been isolated because of technology. You could take everything off the record but John Lennon's rhythm guitar part, and you realize you've been doing it wrong for 10 or 15 years, and you sit down, you do it right, and all of a sudden, it's like there's those moments of like excitement when you realize you found something new that you didn't know it was even there. And when you do it, even though the audience may not really pick out the specific part, but it just sounds right.
Exactly.
You know, it just feels right.
Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
This morning.
Thank you, Chris.
Envy you your job, I'll tell you. Mark Lewis is the founder and original keyboardist of Rain, the Beatles tribute show, and it'll run at the Neil Blaisdell Concert Hall from May 14th to 19th.
Support for The Conversation comes from the First Unitarian Church of Honolulu, located at 2500 Pali Highway, Unitarians of HI.org.
Is there anybody out there? I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a talk with the woman leading the search for intelligent life in the universe, Jill Tarter. Plus, a visit to the expanding universe with the Nobel Prize winner Saul Perlmutter. All coming up on Science Friday from NPR.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HBR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Yokichi Suzuki of Honolulu, Robert Ress of Kailua, and John Appleton of Honolulu for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:26. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. As we talked about earlier in the hour with the executive director of the Mayor's Office of Housing, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell has a new plan for housing Oahu's homeless, and it won't be cheap. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check of the numbers. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Happy Friday.
And a good Friday to you, too. Looking at what this is going to cost us, though, pretty much the first 2 years is covered. The pilot program is covered. But your concern is what happens after that point if the ramp-up goes so well that we now actually have a program that needs to be sustained, right?
That's right. I mean, the cost could nearly double to more than $7 million by that third year. The city's own report shows that. And this is also with the projection that the number of homeless shelters, people that it shelters, will jump to about 152. You know, there's about 500 chronically homeless people on Oahu, and the mayor's plan is to get 100 of those into housing within the next 2 years. And that's something I think everybody feels strongly about. It's been a problem that has been growing. But will this pan out financially? Can it be supported?
Right.
As you know, the council and the mayor are constantly fighting over funds, concerns about federal funding. That's a big question mark.
And when we talked with Jun Yang a little earlier this morning, he was saying, you know, but that's why we have to reapportion some of the monies that we get anyway and look for community partners to make this happen. And it's got more traction this time around. At least that's what they're hoping for, because we've seen other plans fail. But there is a big cost to this. I mean, you're projecting that $31 million a year to house Honolulu's chronically homeless in just another 8 years. That's a lot of money.
By the way, yeah, and that's actually the city's projection. We just looked carefully at their own report on what it's going to cost. That would assume that the city will be housing 600, more than 600 chronically homeless individuals and providing them with the services they need. You know, there's another thing that hasn't been talked about as much, and that's NIMBY. This project is called Housing First. It's something that is a national model, and we tried it here under the Hanneman administration, but without much success. It really didn't go anywhere. Under the Caldwell plan, the idea is to spread it around, have housing in Chinatown and Waikiki and Waianae. Of course, these are the areas that have the highest concentrations of homeless people.
And we talked a little bit about how to combat that. According to Jun Yang, he said that NIMBYism is turning over slowly, and he pointed to Waikiki and many of the residents there, as well as hotel industry folks, saying, okay, we got to do something, and maybe it's time for us to come to the table. So maybe we're at a turning point. We're really not going to know that until 2 years from now.
One other thing on the positive side, the city says, look, you know, we could actually save money by getting homeless off the streets. You know how you clear those tents and that other debris from the city sidewalks? It costs $15,000 every time the city removes those. So there's an area where maybe the city could actually save money by taking care of the homeless and giving them homes.
Or shifting it again, more to go into the pot of shifting what we're going to do in future as opposed to what we've been doing in the past that clearly hasn't worked so well. Have a good weekend, Chad. I'll talk to you on Monday.
Thanks, Beth Ann. You too. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. It's a Friday, and that means we take a look at what's coming up next week in the news department. And Hawaii Public Radio's news director, Bill Dorman, joins us now. Farming at prisons.
Yeah, hey, Beth Ann. It's interesting. One of the things that when you do something like a series that we did a while back on food and Hawaii's food future is that you start to explore themes and then you hear back from people and those themes grow. And this is sort of out of that. A story about a program at Waiava Prison out towards Mililani. It's using aquaponics, which is the combination of growing vegetables with water and simultaneously raising fish. And the fish waste is used as fertilizer. It's one of the things we talked about in that series. This is a growing project out there. They're putting in a couple of more systems. They're working with CTAR, the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources at UH. And the food that they produce goes right into the food services system at the prison. And in terms of the volumes, it's interesting. Just as an example, each bed of lettuce produces between 500 to 800 heads of lettuce a month. And there are 4 beds of them. So you can do the multiplication. And it's a growing program. And now they're going to move on to asparagus.
Which will probably taste better than anything else shipped in.
Well, it's also, in terms of prison food, you know, this is something that it is healthier. And it's also the experience in terms of inmates working in the with the food and in the garden and all. It's a novel program, and it's something that I think folks will be interested
and
in.
And soulful, too.
Yeah, exactly. Couple of other things going. Jobs, always a focus everywhere, but of course hot jobs. It's always a question, not just for people looking for work, but also for those who are in school. You know, what's going to be an area that is fruitful, not just for my first job, but for developing careers. And the 2013 Workforce Job Fair is coming up. Healthcare, of course, is a theme that's been hot lately and in recent years, taking some different directions. But we'll check in on that to see what's
because
going
it is
on.
It is changing. I mean, we saw a lot of people staying in their jobs in healthcare, not just nurses, but other people too who were due to retire, and now that. Life has moved on a little bit, and maybe they've recouped a little bit of what they lost in the last 5 or 7 years. They're going to be outplacing in the next 3 to 5.
Well, it's interesting, too, because, you know, the situation evolves as well. We've got, with the healthcare legislation changes, you have a lot of back office work that's opening up and that's going to be important to not just for patients, but for doctors and the medical system as well. And
right, so who's doing what?
It's healthcare in a different sense as well. So keeping track of sort of those changes and those shifts is something that's really key as well.
You got one more thing to tell me?
Sure. Trouble with sunshine.
Trouble with sunshine.
Trouble with sunshine. Actually, it's solar panels from China. Europe and China have been having discussions about the prices of solar panels, allegations of dumping, and this has been going on for some time. But European Commission is moving closer to putting tariffs on Chinese-made panels, which may actually have some impact here in Hawaii down the line. Again, it's early days, but it's one of those things that's important to keep an eye on. So we'll do that.
We will next week. Thanks to you. Thanks so much. Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director. Kauai coral has been under siege, and we've had several conversations about the discovery and progress of Montipora white syndrome. This week, U.S. Geological Survey wildlife disease specialist Terry Work released his study based on field work done last month. He joins us now with some of his conclusions. And good morning, Terry. They're not good conclusions, but there is a ray of hope. I mean, there's definitely a thread of optimism in here if we're willing to have the political will to take action.
Hi, Beth Ann. Yes, that's exactly right. And thank you for having me on the show. we could actually be a leader in coastal management because what we do on land directly affects the coral reefs. And even though we don't know what's causing the mortality of these Montipora in North Kauai, we do know that there are things we can do to improve the environmental conditions to help these corals recover. And we could be a leader in that arena.
Well, specifically, you know, we're talking about how we manage and develop what's going on land, making sure there isn't the runoff, other things that are being done that are making it even worse for the coral. I mean, your point clearly is if you can't do anything right now about the Montipora, you can do something about everything else that at least you can do, right?
That's right. I mean, we do know the things that we do on the coast that are bad for coral reefs. We know there's a global consensus among coral reef ecologists that land-based pollution, runoff, sedimentation, and overfishing and loss of wetlands, all those things contribute to degradations of coastal ecosystems. And these are things we can do something about. The Native Hawaiians knew this when they had land, you know, land to reef management. They knew that what they did on land affected what happens on the reefs. So because we live on an island and because everything that we do on land is immediately magnified on the reefs, there are things we can do to make the environmental conditions better to help these corals recover. These corals are dying, and that's telling us something. Something's happening in North Kauai, and we need to start paying attention.
And meanwhile, while we're trying to figure out what that threat is that has caused it to come and be so virulent in North Kauai, your point is, why aren't we putting more attention where we know we already can make a difference? Why aren't we doing that?
Well, that's exactly right. And I don't know why that is. It's the analogy is clean drinking water and sewage in humans. I mean, there was a point in human society where we used to live with open sewers and we used to drink basically fecal-laden water. And then somebody wised up and said, you know what? If we manage our sewer correctly and we have clean drinking water, we'll really improve public health in a big way. Yet that mentality seems to stop at the coastline. We have septic tanks, we have rainstorms, where we regularly hear about sewage, you know, dumping in the ocean, and everybody seems to think that's acceptable. Where we are, you know, that mentality stops at the coastline, and we have to change that mentality because what we do on the coast can really affect what we do in our marine ecosystems.
Looking at that, it seems to be, well, you know, when it gets dumped into the ocean, we kind of don't see it. It goes away and everything looks like a pretty picture when you look out on it until you start to see the effects of what we're seeing now that may or may not have a direct impact on the Montipora. But still, we know that we're not managing our coastlines very well.
I disagree with that because I think people are seeing it. I mean, I was when I was doing our investigations in North Kauai, we had tourists coming up to us and telling us, you know, these reefs look really awful. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that the ecosystem is going south. So people are starting to notice, at least on North Kauai, that the reefs are not looking good.
But they're noticing now. I mean, we've been doing this for quite a while. And was it just simply a case of what you don't see, you don't pay attention
to? That is part of the problem. And there needs to be increased public awareness that, you know, you see a beautiful beach and you see a beautiful ocean. But all that is possible because there's an ecosystem underneath that's making that possible. And people are not paying attention to that, and they need to start paying attention.
So what are you doing to make people pay attention?
Well, I'm trying to get the word out through good science. Primarily, that's our mission, is to provide the science to the decision managers. But we are not a regulatory agency, so I can't really make – all I can do is try to get the word out and increase public awareness in my own little way.
So is DLNR paying attention?
I think they are. I know that we had DLNR biologists with us last month on the disease investigation. So I know that the DLNR biologists on Kauai are definitely concerned about this. Whether that's going to translate up the food chain, I'm not sure.
Because concentrating on what they're finding with Montipora is one thing, but being able to say, you know, this other stuff here that we've been doing for a while, it's not so good. Maybe we should stop that and stop it now.
And the other thing to think about, too, is that, you know, we can't just lean on DLNR to change the situation. The community in North Kauai, where this is occurring, has to decide whether it's important to preserve the coral reefs. And once the community makes that decision, they're going to have to make the hard choices of what it is that we can implement in that region to improve the environmental conditions enough to help these corals. This is really a community-based decision. It can't just be top-down while the government said, thou shalt.
So what's a hard decision that you think that they should be
making? Well, land use patterns. I mean, you know, I've been swimming sometimes in Hanalei Bay where the water looks like chocolate milk. That clearly is not right. So we're doing something about sediment management, you know, upstream sediment management. That's one thing we could work on. Cesspools is another thing we could work on. But all these things take some sacrifice and they take some money. But again, the communities need to make the hard decisions as to what they want to do with those.
You're talking in large part about political will to make it happen.
That's right.
And not just to sit there and bemoan how terrible it is and why doesn't somebody do something.
Right, exactly. And you know, I mean, everybody has a stake in coral reefs. Whether we like it or not, we promote them. We have a tourist industry. And people, you know, eventually, this, you know, if the ecosystem degrades and they come to an area to look at beautiful ecosystems, they're eventually going to go elsewhere. So, you know, we all have a stake in this. And I think it's important that, you know, the community's got to make that decision. If they're happy with the status quo, there's nothing I'm going to do to change it.
But economically, their dependence on people who come to visit Kauai and spend money with them, will the pocketbook have to be the driver on this one too?
I don't know.
Not just the other reasons for doing it?
That is something, again, the community needs to make that decision. I have no way to really make that assessment.
But at least your latest report gives them good science so they can see exactly what's happening as of now.
That's our role, is to provide the science and the managers and the politicians make the decisions.
And the next report, when do you go out next?
That remains to be seen.
All right. That means we'll have to be in contact with you and we'll find out. And as we do, we'll let you know too. Thanks very much, Terry, for coming in.
Thank you for your time.
Terry Work, DVM, is a wildlife disease specialist and project leader with the U.S. Geological Survey, Honolulu Field Station. He completed a residency in wildlife medicine at UC Davis and worked for the California Department of Fish and Game as a wildlife veterinarian before coming to Hawaii in 1992. His report on the Kauai coral situation is on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Earlier in the show, we talked about Lanai's haunted past. Up till about 1500 AD, Hawaiians did not settle there. They believed it glowed with evil mana and was the home of demons. So instead of being settled, Lanai became a place of banishment. Ancient lawbreakers were either put to death or sent to what was called the molten home of evil spirits. We asked you who or what finally changed Lanai into a safe place. Well, legend has it that the king of Maui's nephew, the son of ancient Lahaina's chief, had so offended his majesty that the young man was about to be put to death. However, Lahaina's people pleaded for his life, and he was banished to Lanai instead. The king of Maui told him that if he could get rid that island of demons, all would be forgiven, and he could return home. Well, the young chief had mana of his own, and he did defeat the demons, casting them out of Lanai and sending them to Koho'olawe. Ever since, Lanai has been certified safely demon-free thanks to its original ghostbuster, young chief Kaulu La'au. That's our quiz for today, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, good morning. I'm Miles Kubo from Energy Industries. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
What is the link between our behavior and the movement of celestial bodies? More than we know about, that's for sure. Every culture from the beginning of time has looked to the sky for guidance and clues as to how we should live. And we're in a new moon phase right now. It's a time that Heather Salmon describes as a time for spiritual gardening, to release all that is no longer serving us. She's the high priestess at the Black Swan Temple in Haiku, Maui, and she's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
Morning, Chris. I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on this show this morning.
Sure.
Noon.
You were telling me that this is the time of the new moon is a pretty significant time for people. Why is that?
It is because we're on this planet Earth and everything moves in cycles. We have a cycle of birth, life, death, repeat. It continues on and on. In our modern world, we are in such a focus of just growing, accumulating. So we tend to forget about how to hospice the death of the old in a graceful way. And so we end up getting stuck in hoarding, and we're seeing all this obesity and all these imbalances. So the new moon is a time, it's the time, the end of the old cycle and the beginning of the new. So we need to do our spiritual gardening, what needs to be hospiced, what needs to be weeded out of our gardens, and what do we want to plant for the next cycle.
Heather, I'm interested in your use of the word hospice. It implies a sort of a gentle putting to rest of something, right?
That's right. That's right. Whether we're finished and completing a project, it's a way of bringing the ceremony, the honoring and reverence and connection back with nature and with our lives. We are part of nature.
How does that process, an internal process, relate to the movement of the spheres?
And internally, well, you know, externally, we're always, nobody has any problem usually taking a shower or giving yourself an external bath or cleanse. There's things that we can do, meditations that we can do to give ourselves the internal rinsing, internal washing. A lot of spiritual teachers talk about coming to a place of emptiness. And it's really that place of emptiness so we can fill ourselves up with the divine light, with our own spirit, and ask for guidance and get more clarity.
Heather, what is it that we need to empty out? Just all that white noise inside the brain?
Well, it could be anything on a physical level. We can be emptying out any toxins from our bodies. We can, a lot of people do a little fasting cleansing around the new moons.
Mm-hmm.
So being a little lighter on the body and literally, cleansing has really shown that we can help to jumpstart and strengthen the body and strengthen the immune system. On a mental level, we can be cleansing out thought patterns, belief systems, attitudes. We always need to be questioning what is really true, or are we just going along like sheeple with the herd and kind of blindly following, and what kind of results are we getting? Are we happy with those results? So it's time for us to come into a little bit more maturity and recognize that we are co-creators here, and that we, our thoughts and beliefs and attitudes are co-creating our experience. And if we want to change our experience, we need to monitor what's going on with our own internal processes.
Well, fair enough, Heather. What's the benefit of aligning that internal gardening with the moon cycle?
Well, each moon cycle, I like to call we have 12 months, 12 moons of the year, and 12 moons of the zodiac, and I like to refer to them as the 12 disciples.
Uh-huh.
So each one brings a new lesson, a new opportunity, a new way of looking at life and insight into the cycle of life and what we are gifted, what energies we are working with.
So each one is a little bit different? Do they have different characteristics?
Absolutely, absolutely.
What's the characteristic of the one we're in now?
Okay, well, we're at the beginning. This is the new moon in Taurus.
Mm-hmm.
We just, last month, we had the new moon in Aries, which was the first new moon of the year. I mean, the first new moon of the astrological zodiac.
Uh-huh.
So Aries is about inspiration. Bringing forth new ideas. It's a masculine sign, and that thought. So it's like the seed. And then Taurus, which is what we're in now, is the sign of the Earth Mother, the goddess, coming to life. So what do we do when we, how do we create life? We plant seeds into the earth, and the earth, that earth needs to be fertile and to receive and able to receive those seeds. So now we are receiving the seeds. This is a time of spring in most parts of North America. This is a time when the earth is coming back to life and regenerating. So literally, what are we planting for our gardens? This is a time to focus on what we want to grow for the next solar cycle. So, and this is a time exactly when we want our to cultivate our land. It's great. People say spring cleansing. This is why. Because we need to cultivate that land. We need to weed out our gardens and make it fertile so it can receive those seeds. So we've got a great opportunity to fully manifest that which we desire.
So there's a real benefit to aligning your personal journey in a way with the astrological calendar, with the cycles of the earth, the cycles of the seasons. Sounds like
absolutely.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It can make people feel more connected, you know, in our modern world where we're not so connected anymore with the natural world. You know, that's why we were seeing so many imbalances, even on an emotional or mental level, because we've lost our connection with the Aina. We've lost the connection with the energy and the spirit of the earth and the celestial stars, but we are part of them, so we're not separate.
Well, Heather,
the more we come into understanding our connection, the more ease we and grace we have moving through life.
Does your teaching have a lot of its roots in the ancient world, various, you know, the teachings of various ancient cultures?
It does. It does. I am an ordained Essene minister, and the Essenes were Jesus and Mary and Joseph and John the Baptist were believed to be Essenes in the beginning of Christianity, and they walked the path of peace, the sevenfold path of peace. So that is one aspect, and they were all about reconnecting with nature, honoring Mother Earth and Father, our Heavenly Father, and creating peace with the body, peace with the mind, the family, culture, humanity. And the other, I'm also in a priestess of Isis, which is the mystery and the magic of ceremony and ritual, and we honor in our temple all paths. So we love the Hawaiian path, and I've been here, become good friends with Auntie Pua, who is a Hawaiian kahuna and elder here, and she talks about the path of forgiveness.
Well, Heather, I'm afraid we've got to run, but it sounds as if you've done a lot of study of a lot of ancient teachings, and thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Okay, thank you, and we'll be doing a Mother's Day event this Sunday.
Well, we'll look for that. Thank you. Heather Salmon is the High Priestess at the Black Swan Temple in Haiku, Maui, and details are on our HPR website.
Virtuoso guitarist Ian O'Sullivan has been described as thoughtful by Classical Guitar Magazine and delightful by the Honolulu Star Advertiser. In his Atherton debut, Ian played to a standing room only audience. This year, he's promising a combination of Bach and Paraguayan composer Augustin Barrios, as well as local composers Jeff Peterson, Bailey Matsuda, and Byron Yasui, when he performs in HBR's Atherton studio on Saturday, May 18th at 7:30. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours.
Montipora, it's a whole new danger to the reef that's essentially been discovered here in Hawaii, yeah?
Well, it's around the world, too, but about a little over a year ago, found on Kauai reefs. The question really is, what do we do that we can do? Because finding what that link is that brought it to Kauai that makes it particularly virulent in particular areas around the world, that's still an open question. The real thing is, what are we going to do about all the other stuff that we can possibly impact right now if there's the political will?
And there's a great deal that we can do right now. And I was talking to Terry before the show, and he was pointing out that Kaneohe Bay has made great strides in restoring the reef, and that really should be what's going on everywhere.
Because people wanted to get it done.
Exactly. That's political will and also social will, you know, just social change.
Well, we're going to wait and see if that's what happens on Kauai, because surely there are people who have been knowing that this has been going on for a while. That's going to do it for us for this week. But coming up on Monday, how can people nowhere near the top of the Homelands wait list jump the line? We'll talk with the president of the Association of Hawaiians for Homestead Land about what she says are unfair practices.
And we'll review the new guidelines for prostate cancer and get perspectives on Hawaii from a variety of the authors featured at this year's Book and Music Festival.
In the meantime, talk back to us. It could be a little bit more productive than just talking back to your radio. Find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR.
Hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information on the archive on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. You also can sign up for the podcast so it'll come to you. Our executive producer is Bethann Kozovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Maddie DeShazo is our production assistant, and Andy Walters is our intern.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. The rest of the music is a team effort, and I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Bethann Kozlovich. We'll join you on Monday when we pick up the conversation. Have a good weekend.